Laudato Jesus Christus, Vatican and World News.
In the headlines this Saturday, February 15th, the European Union considers taking urgent measures amid deadly fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Pope Francis remains in hospital in Rome, receiving treatment for bronchitis. But first, the sixth round of prisoner exchanges takes place between Israel and Hamas. In the Vatican, I'm Kelsey Gussie. The ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas is now apparently back on track, after a week in which it seemed close to collapse, following reports of alleged breaches in the deal. With the ceasefire continuing, Saturday marked the sixth round of prisoner exchanges between the two, since the ceasefire agreement came into effect on January 19th. Nathan Morley reports.
In Gaza, Hamas handed over three Israeli hostages to the Red Cross. They've been identified as Alexander Trufanov, Yir Horn, and Sagui Dekel Chen, who were kidnapped by Hamas during the attack on Israel back in October 2023. Dekel Chen is 36 and a US citizen. Trufanov is 29 and an Israeli. And Horn is 46 and an Israeli and Argentine citizen. The release was being carried out as part of the ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, Israel is releasing 369 Palestinian prisoners in return. Some have arrived in the West Bank, more are expected a little bit later. This is the sixth prisoner exchange since the ceasefire between these parties came into effect on January the 19th. The continuation of this truce, which has now lasted around 4 weeks, was in jeopardy earlier this week when Hamas threatened to freeze the release of hostages due to alleged ceasefire violations by Israel. Israel, in turn, said it would resume fighting if the hostages were not released. Negotiations are currently underway to implement the second phase of the ceasefire. Previously, Hamas has released 21 hostages and Israel has released over 730 Palestinian prisoners. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has increased its presence in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. In other regional developments, parties attending a Paris conference on Syria have vowed to support the country's transition. In a joint statement, the participants vowed to support Syria in achieving a peaceful, credible, orderly, and swift inclusive transition, in line with the key principles of UN Security Council Resolution 2254. For Vatican Radio, this is Nathan Morley reporting.
And since the ceasefire deal took effect, UNICEF has been able to increase the distribution of supplies and aid to the 1 million children in the Gaza Strip in need of basic services. Speaking to UN News, Tess Ingram, communications director and spokesperson for UNICEF, describes the situation in the Gaza Strip as the Children's Fund is able to bring trucks with aid to the children by focusing on three important aspects: providing water, health and nutrition, and helping people survive the winter.
The situation in Gaza remains catastrophic for children. It's a good situation in that the bombs and the bullets have stopped falling, killing children, injuring children, but the humanitarian crisis continues. I was just in Gaza for 2 weeks and I met with many children who are struggling still to meet their basic needs, to receive mental health and psychosocial support. And of course, no child is still back at school. For the children in Gaza, they urgently need humanitarian assistance. They need both supplies and services to scale up quickly. And the ceasefire is a really good opportunity for us to do that. We obviously had some difficulties in bringing in aid during the war, and now we have scaled up with thousands of trucks coming in the past 3 weeks and more on the way. UNICEF is focused on three priorities at the moment. We're focused on making sure that water flows again, particularly in the areas where water has been really badly damaged. Pipes have been damaged, wells have been damaged in the north and in Rafah. So we're trying to bring water back by doing repairs and also starting water trucking so families have immediate access to water. We're also prioritising health and nutrition. We're bringing in medical supplies and nutrition treatments for children and also scaling up services to help identify the children that need those nutrition treatments because they're malnourished. We're also trying to build up capacity again for neonatal care, particularly intensive care in hospitals, because so much of that infrastructure again, was destroyed during the war. For example, I went to Al-Shifa Hospital, and there used to be 55 neonatal incubators there before the war, and now there are zero. That whole department doesn't exist anymore. So we're trying to rebuild capacity by bringing in those suppliers and helping doctors restart those units. And our last priority is helping people cope with this winter weather. It's still really cold in Gaza, and I saw so many children without shoes, without jackets. And so we're focused on bringing in those items, those clothing items for children, as well as tarpaulins for families, because there are, of course, many families who don't have a home or have returned to what they hoped would still be a home but is now rubble.
That was Tess Ingram, Communications Director and spokesperson for UNICEF, speaking to UN News about the dire situation of children in the Gaza Strip. And in other world news, the European Union says it is considering taking urgent measures amid deadly fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Meanwhile, residents in Bouvaku, the DRC's second largest city in the east of the country, reportedly fled by the thousands on Saturday to escape the advance of M23 Rwanda-backed rebels. Linda Bordoni reports.
Panic swept through Bukavu on Saturday as residents scrambled to escape the looming advance of Rwanda-backed rebels. They are reportedly bracing for the chaos and looting that have erupted throughout the militia's push to gain territory since January the 26th. Nearly 3,000 people have been killed since then in the clashes between the rebels and DRC government forces, and some 350,000 have been displaced. In Bukavu, a city of about 1.3 million people that lies 100 kilometres south of rebel-held Goma, those who couldn't flee waited in their homes, shocked by the vacuum left by Congolese soldiers who abandoned their posts. The M23 rebels are backed by about 4,000 troops from neighbouring Rwanda. They are the most prominent of more than 100 armed groups vying for control of Congo's mineral-rich east. This latest push by the M23 has resulted in encompassing more territory than rebels had previously seized and poses an unprecedented challenge to the central government in Kinshasa. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference on Friday, DR Congo's president Felix Tshisekedi called for Rwanda to be sanctioned, accusing it of having expansionist ambitions. Meanwhile, the continent's heads of state are meeting for the African Union summit in Ethiopia, and the European Union also said it was urgently considering all options in response to the widening rebel offensive. International observers and the UN Refugee Agency and Children's Fund have denounced widespread violations of humanitarian law and horrific abuse of children, whom they say are subjected to rape and recruited by rebel fighters and Congolese soldiers. I'm Linda Bordoni.
British Foreign Minister David Lammy said on Saturday he would encourage U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky to deepen their partnership in the future. Britain and Ukraine signed a landmark 100-year partnership agreement last month to deepen security ties and strengthen their country's relationship. Lammy said the best security guarantee for Ukraine against future Russian aggression was binding U.S. industry, business, and defense capability into its future. On February 24th, Ukraine will mark the third anniversary of the full-scale invasion from Russia. As Joseph Tulloch reports, the day is set to become a national day of prayer and remembrance.
The Ukrainian parliament has declared that the 24th of February, that is the third anniversary of the full-scale Russian invasion in 2022, will become a nationwide day of prayer. Alexander Yazlovetsky, the auxiliary bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Kyiv, Zitomir, spoke to Vatican Radio about the announcement.
Per la maggior parte degli ucraini, questo giorno, il 24 febbraio, evocherà sempre.
For most Ukrainians, this day will always evoke negative emotions, bringing to mind a wound that will bleed for a long time to come. The bishop added that the day's transformation into a national day of prayer would allow the occasion to also represent an expression of gratitude to God. Gratitude, the bishop said, for saving our country from Russian occupation and preserving our independence. Bishop Yazlovetsky highlighted that the day of prayer would also be an opportunity to ask God for a just and speedy peace, and also for the protection of Ukrainian soldiers so that they might return safely to their families. We will also ask for prisoners to be freed, the bishop stressed, and pray for the wounded and for the dead, soldiers and civilians. Bishop Yazovetsky added that the day of prayer would also be an opportunity for dialogue between different Christian churches and between different religions.
Il nemico che ha invaso il nostro paese ha unito il nostro popolo per difendere la propria indipendenza. Il nemico oggi
Russia has united our people in defending our independence and also united our people in prayer. I'm Joseph Tulloch.
And as the new diplomatic efforts are underway to resolve the conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine, Cardinal Pietro Parolin has reaffirmed the need for a new multilateral diplomatic approach to address the current crises, which would be focused on dialogue, patience, and trust building. Speaking with Italian newspaper L'Ecco di Bergamo, the Vatican Secretary of State reiterated that peace requires courage, justice, and forgiveness. Lisa Zangarini tells us more in this report.
In the wide-ranging interview with the editor of L'Ecco di Bergamo, Cardinal Parolin addressed several pressing geopolitical issues, including the conflicts in the Middle East and Europe. Central to his reflection was that solutions to conflicts should never be imposed unilaterally, as such approaches prevent the establishment of a just and lasting peace. Asked about the inherent difficulties that international diplomacy faces today in addressing complex situations such as the wars in Gaza and Ukraine, the Vatican Secretary of State noted that the primary obstacle is the widespread mutual distrust and fear that fuel polarization and hinder constructive dialogue. He also reaffirmed that an increasingly prevalent club mentality in global politics further exacerbates diplomatic inefficacy. To overcome these challenges, Cardinal Parolin suggested a different diplomatic approach, rooted in what Pope Francis calls a diplomacy of hope, focused on dialogue, patience, and trust building. Such an approach, he said, would be an alternative to the prevailing dynamics of confrontation and exclusion, proposing instead a framework that prioritizes understanding and long-term reconciliation. This is why, Cardinal Parolin added, it is essential to believe in multilateralism and strengthen the role of international institutions such as the United Nations, ensuring they can operate more effectively and representatively. Echoing Pope Francis and Pope St. John Paul II's words, Cardinal Parolin also emphasized that peace requires courage, justice, and forgiveness, three values, he said, that seem increasingly absent in modern society. Turning to Europe, Cardinal Parolin said that if the continent is to continue to have a voice and role in the current world context, it must return to its historical and cultural roots that once gave Europe its strength and vision. I am Lisa Zingarini.
And finally, Pope Francis had a restful night and slept well, Vatican Press Office Director Matteo Bruni informed journalists on Saturday morning. He said the Holy Father, who was admitted to Rome's Agostino Gemelli Hospital on Friday for a respiratory tract infection, had breakfast and read newspapers as he continues his pharmacological treatment and medical tests. Bruni stated that the Pope's fever has not worsened and that further updates on his condition will be provided in the afternoon. The Vatican Press Office had announced on February 14th that Pope Francis was experiencing a slight fever upon his admission and had begun hospital-based medical treatment. That brings us to the end of this edition of Vatican and World News. For more on these and other stories, please visit vaticannews.va, where we will continue to update you on the Pope's health. Many thanks go to the wonderful Daniele Giorgi in studio. In the Vatican, I'm Kelsey Gussie.